I didn't make it onto the stage that much, actually, if I'm being very honest. I didn't get cast as anybody's family because I didn't look like anybody's family.
But he showed up at this party and he was like this just ball of intense energy, and he was so cool, and he had a Camaro, and, you know, I was like just so overwhelmed with this person.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
I'm Jessica Hankin. And this week on the podcast, This Changed Everything. Two young women set out on another course after a loss.
So before we get started with our stories today, we want to thank Park School of Baltimore, an independent K-12 progressive school in North Baltimore. So this first storyteller, Stephanie Ibarra, is the artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage. And she shared this story at a show we did at the Johns Hopkins Carey School of Business with a group called Women in Business. And the story is really about the way a failure or a crook in the road can actually set you on the path you're supposed to be on. So take a listen.
I really wanted to be an actor ever since I was a little kid. I don't remember a single show that did it or some sort of lightning bolt moment. It was just always there inside of me. I wanted to be an actor and tell stories. And I subjected friends and family to all manner of performances, whether they wanted to see them or not, throughout my entire childhood. And I seized every opportunity that I could in my hometown of San Antonio, Texas, to audition for whether it was the church play or the middle school play. I was just really committed to this thing. And my parents, being musicians, didn't have a leg to stand on in terms of their support of my artistry. So when it came time for me to apply to colleges, I said, Mom, Dad, I want to study acting. And they're like, awesome. So they were really supportive. I'm very lucky that they said, go, do it. So I ended up at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, which is a slightly bigger town than it was now than it was then. It's about 90 minutes south of the very big city of Dallas-Fort Worth. And I was inside of this really small theater department studying acting. And I got to work on my craft, you know, my voice and my movement and all of my classes. The thing is that I didn't make it onto the stage that much, actually, if I'm being very honest. I was the only one who looked like me in my program. And I didn't get cast as anybody's family because I didn't look like anybody's family, that kind of thing. So it was a little tough. But things started to look up for me at the end of my sophomore year of college. I had the opportunity to apply for an acting internship up in Dallas, the big city, and with this theater collective. So I would get to spend the summer sort of interning at all of these different theaters around Dallas. And I was so excited. I was convinced like this was going to be my big break. I was going to break into the Dallas theater scene and take them all by storm. So I had to prepare a monologue, and I had to do an interview with a panel. I prepared my monologue. I drove up 90 minutes to Dallas. I don't remember the monologue to this day, but I remember very vividly the table of people. And there, I don't remember how many there were. In my mind now, there were like 100, but I'm sure there were like 6. And they were sitting behind the table at these chairs, very lovely faces, but I was terrified. I remember that feeling of just being paralyzed. But I got through the monologue. I remembered every word. And then it came time for the interview. And they were just asking me these questions. They're peppering me with questions about my craft. So it was fine. Like, what kind of artist was I? And what kind of actor did I want to be? And I thought I was doing really well. There was this woman to my left who was insistent on asking me questions, not about my craft, but about like my bigger career ambitions, whatever that means. And I was positive that she hated me because she would just ask the question. She never smiled when she asked the question. She would ask it really directly and then just sort of not give me any kind of feedback, no affirmation whatsoever about my whether my answer had been right or wrong. And one of these questions was, would you ever consider running a theater? And I had to stop because I had never considered the question before. And I thought about it and I said, yes, yes, I would totally consider running a theater. And she just said, thank you. So I got through the interview and at the end of the day, I found out I did not get that internship. They said no, no big break for me in Dallas, Texas. I had to go back to Waco. So I went back to Waco. I was really heartbroken. Didn't know what I was going to do with my summer. And then I got up the next morning, went to class, and one of my professors said, Stephanie, I need to see you in my office. You know, heard you didn't get the internship. Sorry about that. Robin Flatt called. Robin Flatt would really like to talk to you as soon as possible. Can you please get back in your car and go back up to Dallas? So I did. And I walked into the Dallas Children's Theater to meet Robin Flatt, the founding artistic director of the Dallas Children's Theater, otherwise known as the woman to my left. And Robin said, I'm so pissed. She was like, I'm so angry that you did not get that internship. It should have been you. I can't believe they didn't pick you. I pick you. So she offered me right then and there, she offered me my own internship that she had created for me inside of 12 hours. And I accepted. And when I showed up for my first day of my internship, she took me to the office of her second in command, Susan. And she said, Susan, this is Stephanie. I want you to show her around the place. And over the course of the summer, I would like for you to teach her everything there is to know about running this place. And that's exactly what Susan did. I spent the summer between my, so that was between my sophomore and junior year, and then between my junior and senior year. Back at Dallas Children's Theater. And then Robin went on to offer me my very first job as an actor. She offered me my very first job as sort of my day job as a fundraising professional. And when I look back now at that very simple question to consider a thing I had never considered before, it seems impossible that that moment could have happened, but it also seems impossible that it wouldn't happen, that it wouldn't have happened, because today I'm standing here on this stage running a theater. And today I take great joy and pride and great sort of, I carry this next thing with a great amount of humility and responsibility to women who look like me, in particular, women of color, to invite that kind of imagining of oneself in a different light, to invite the inquisition into what might be, what might you not have considered, what might be available that you haven't thought of before. I will never, ever forget that question and the ripple effect it had on my life. And I'm just so looking forward to doing that for others. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a perfect, you know, it's what you or I would want to tell our daughters every time that there is a setback or a challenge, like, just wait, just, you know, there's going to be another opportunity. This is an opportunity.
Right. Well, right. And the other thing, too, is this idea that when the woman said to her, you know, you could be an artistic leader, that thought had never occurred to her.
Yeah.
Like, she didn't know anybody who did that. And I was actually talking to my daughter last night, and I was saying, you know, when I grew up, the people I knew through my parents were accountants, lawyers, business people, teachers. There was nobody in the arts. And so it didn't, because I was saying to her, I thought I would be a lawyer. And she said, why did you change? And I was like, well, because I learned in college that you actually could be a writer, that was something like a person could do.
Although you'd be a really good lawyer.
I know.
Like a terrifying lawyer.
I would love that. And there are many a days when I'm sitting in front of the blank screen where I'm like, God, I could be like tearing someone a new one in court right now.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't I be doing that?
Yeah.
But anyway, just this idea that if you can't like imagine something, you can't do it. I think I find that just a really like a big truth about life.
And she is absolutely now a leader in the theater community in Baltimore and throughout, up and down the East Coast.
Exactly. I mean, and then other people are now saying, oh, well, I could do this because she does this. That's like the kind of the domino effect that's so great. Before we get to the next story, we want to thank Baltimore Magazine. You can find them at baltimoremagazine.com or on the newsstand. And you can check out Local Flavor Live there. Local food podcast.
We also want to thank the Golden West, which is a vegan forward restaurant located on the Avenue in Hamden. They've been around since 1997. They are truly delicious.
So this next storyteller, Shirley Hale Kozlowski, and just a little interesting tidbit, her given name was Shirley because she is where she's from, as she tells us in this story. But I have a vivid memory of talking with her on the phone this fall. It was a beautiful fall day, and I had my headphones on, and I was talking to her while I was weeding in my yard. And just the reason I remember it is that the story is so sad and beautiful. And I love stories. I love sort of anything that...
You love stories?
That contain... two really different emotions at once. I like all sorts of things like that. TV shows, movies, books, anything where they can really have these two tones or more than two tones. And so I just vividly remember listening to this and being so excited about this story and so enjoying talking with her and pulling all these weeds in my garden. And yeah, so here we go.
So in 1979, I was a 15-year-old girl living in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, with my parents. My dad was a long-haul trucker, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. I had a couple siblings at home as well. I was 15 years old, and I was dating my first love. He was a couple years older than me. He was this fiery... long, red, curly-haired person. We had met at a party a couple years prior. I was very young. He was a little older, but he showed up at this party, and he was like this just ball of intense energy, and he was so cool, and he had a Camaro, and, you know, I was, like, just so overwhelmed with this person, so... Anyway, we had this like crazy, you know, love affair where, you know, you're young and you're, you know, hot 1 minute and fighting the next and, you know, break up, get back together, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, the night of June 9th, 1979, we were hanging out at his apartment. He was only child. He had a kind of a bad relationship with his parents. And so he had dropped out of high school because he was a badass and wouldn't follow rules. And he dropped out of high school. He got an apartment. He got a job. He was a mechanic. And so we're hanging out at his apartment that night, Friday night. And our good friend Steve came over. And we were all going to go to this party that we had been so looking forward to. It was a really big deal. Everybody was going to be there. So we are, you know, hanging out in Joel's apartment, and we are eating Chinese food. We got takeout. We're, you know, pre-gaming before the party. And, you know, we start talking about how we want to die. So Steve goes first, and Steve's like, I want to go really fast. I don't want to know what happened. I just want it bang, done. Not feel anything. Joel, on the other hand, who is like typical, you know, fireball self, is like, I want to feel everything. I want to live the last minute of it. I want to feel it. You only do it once, you know. I want to be there, you know, for every second. I, on the other hand, was like, I think I want to be an old lady and just go in my sleep, like, peacefully and just... drift away. So we have that conversation.
then we are like, all right, let's get ready. Let's go to the party. It's 9:30. We go out into the parking lot, and we're walking toward Steve's truck, who he, you know, was going to drive. So he has this International Harvester Scout truck, which is like a Blazer Jeep thing. And it's beat to shit because he four-wheel drives all the time, and it's got all these dents and everything. And he had just come back from the shop from his dad's mechanic thing, and they had just done work on it or whatever. So we're walking out in the parking lot, and Steve gets in the driver's side, and I'm tagging behind. And I just see, I can see the truck, and all of a sudden it's like this, like, black blanket just comes over top of me. It's like just blackness, and all I see is the truck. And I'm like, this feeling of dread that I've never felt before is like just washing over me, and I'm just standing there going, like, just staring with like a horrible feeling. So Joel turns around and goes, "What are you doing, man? Come on." And I'm like, okay. So go running up. He gets in the passenger seat. I get on his lap because I'm 15 years old and have to be on my boyfriend. So I'm, you know, like this. And we're driving to the party. And all of a sudden, I just start dozing out. And I'm like, wake up, out, wake up. It just keeps happening. So he's like, hey, you seem really tired. Do you want to go home? And I'm like, I think I do want to go home. Yeah, take me home. They reroute, take me to my house. I get out with him, give him a kiss, tell him I'll call him tomorrow at the shop when I get up, whatnot. They drive off. I go in the house. My mom's like, what are you doing home? I thought you were going to this party. And I'm like, I got really tired. I don't know. I just want to go to sleep. So I go upstairs. I go to bed. The next morning, I wake up. And my mom hears me rustling around. She comes in the room, and she has this face on like something horrible has happened. And I immediately think it's my dad. Something happened on the road, you know, and I'm like, Mom, what happened? What's going on? Something happened to Dad. And she's like, no, honey, I'm so sorry. Joel and Steve died last night in a car accident. And I'm like, what? And it's not making any sense. And she's hugging me and she's crying. And I'm just saying, why can't I cry? I can't cry. And I just repeat that. So the next couple of days, I don't remember really to this day anything about those 2 days. Day three was both their funerals. So I went to both of the funerals. And day four, Joel's father, Marv, comes to my house with a police officer, and he's like, you know, I brought an officer, we're trying to figure out what happened, what were you guys doing before you went to the party? And I said, eating Chinese food, talking, hanging out, you know, getting ready to go to the party. We were driving to the party, I got tired, they took me home, and that's it. So I asked the officer, what happened? And the officer was like, well, what we figured out was that they were driving down County Line Road, and it's a four-lane road, and they were going down the hill at 60 miles an hour. They careened across, the back axle broke, and they went careening across the oncoming lanes, smashed into a telephone pole, snapped it in half, and Steve's neck broke instantly. The truck then swerved back out into the middle of the road. It flipped upside down, and the top smashed down to the door handles. And then it went down, and it stopped in the middle of the street. And my friend Pat Hennessy saw the whole thing happen. He got out of his car, ran over, was pulling on the door handle, and Joel was screaming for help. And he couldn't get the door open, and it started smoking, and it caught on fire. And he died in a blaze, basically, exactly like he said. And then I was home sleeping. So out of that horribleness, his parents basically took me on as their own kid. Like, even though I had my family, they became like a huge part of my life. So they're, you know, at my art things, my music things, they're, you know, totally involved in everything from that point on. And it was like I was their connection to Joel, and they were my connection to him. So then they were wealthy. My parents weren't. They traveled a lot after that. They went on so many trips. They'd go to Carnival every year in Brazil and, you know, come back and show me these pictures and say, you know, you can do this. You can get out of this town. You can get out of Huntington Valley and see the world, you know, like, look at all of this. So when I graduated high school, a week later, I moved to Spain with my then Spanish boyfriend. and came back 10 months later and wanted to go to college. And my parents didn't have the money to send me. Nobody in my family went to college, and me and my sister were the only people who graduate high school. So when I wanted to go and I couldn't get financial aid, my parents couldn't, you know, send me, they offered to use Joel's college fund that they had saved up. So they sent me to Berklee College of Music with that. I know, kind of amazing, huh? So from that, you know, it's like, it's just kind of amazing to me because it's like the trajectory of my life changed on that night. I don't know, it's just incredible. And it's just kind of mystical at the same time because, you know, it's like I carried that love with me from both, you know, both happening. It's like them going and then this gift that was given to me. So I just wanted to share that.
From now, we'll all be gone. All our friends will move away.
So that's Shirley's amazing story. She is now the owner with her husband of two restaurants, Babies on Fire. Actually, the same restaurant, two locations.
Yeah.
And she's a leader in the women in punk rock community in Baltimore.
And just this knowledge, I think this profound knowledge that she lives a life that was enabled by the death of another.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of some of the really beautiful transplant stories I've heard where you are, as a recipient of a liver transplant or a heart transplant, you are aware that your life is enabled by someone else's death.
Yep.
And I find that so profound and beautiful that she never would have gone to college. She never would have traveled in Europe. She never would have done anything she did had, you know, her high school boyfriend lived. And it's not that she wished, it's not that she says, this was good, this should have happened, I'm glad this happened. It's just that you have to hold both the death and the life in your hand at the same time. And I love that.
And while you're holding death and life in your hand, you can go to the wine store.
In your third hand.
Yeah.
Just hold your bottle of wine.
Hold your wine with your feet.
Can you do that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
that's great. You hold the stem of the wine glass in your
like
your toes.
Like a monkey, like a little
love
monkey.
It. Everybody get that visual picture of Jessica holding a wine glass. And then can you lift it to your mouth without dripping
Absolutely
any of it?
Absolutely not a drop.
Or you just have a really long straw that goes
No, I don't need a straw. It's not good for the environment. What's wrong with you?
A metal straw. A paper straw? We use metal. Anyway. Okay. So we want to thank the wine sources Jessica has. And we also want to tell you to visit stoopstorytelling.com where you can find out about all of our events.
Absolutely. And Maureen Harvey, thank you. Thank you for being a producer extraordinaire and so patient with us.
Everybody try that trick that Jessica did with the stem wine glass.
It helps
between
to have a very skinny stem.
Right. And short legs.
And long toes.
Short legs, long toes, skinny wine glass. There you go, people. See you next week.